A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one, and it's a heavy one. He's asking how you maintain situational awareness in a volatile security environment when life is also just relentlessly demanding. He and his wife are moving apartments with a one-year-old. He's been through the Iran War, the ceasefires, the collapse of those ceasefires, the one-day resurrection after the second one. He's maintained a go bag and checklists and SOPs, and he's gotten good at raising his alert level when things look like they're about to escalate. But the core question is, how do you keep that antenna up without burning out entirely, especially when the government's messaging inspires zero confidence and everyone around you just wants to tune out the world?
The detail that hit me hardest, he mentioned missing the ballistic missile launch before the first Iranian war because he'd taken a few days off from the news. It was relatives abroad messaging him asking what it was like that tipped him off.
Which is a very specific kind of awful. The how bad is it where you are? Text from someone watching CNN in another time zone.
That's exactly the failure mode he's trying to prevent. The question isn't whether to stay informed, it's how to do it without letting the information eat your whole brain.
Let's start with the actual threat picture, because volatile environment can mean a lot of things. What's actually happening on the ground right now?
The Northern Front is fraying. We've got Israeli strikes in Lebanon that killed 32 people just recently, and that's putting US-Iran diplomatic talks in serious jeopardy. There's a Jerusalem Post piece on this from this week. The strikes have essentially thrown a wrench into what was already a very fragile diplomatic channel. And simultaneously, Israel and Hezbollah are continuing strikes despite the ceasefire agreement being technically in place.
Ceasefire doing a lot of heavy lifting there.
It always does. The term has become almost meaningless in practice. You've got a formal agreement, but the strikes haven't stopped. It's not a full-scale war, but it's also not a war. And that's the hardest regime to plan around, the in-between.
Then there's the Trump Memorandum of Understanding. Daniel called it a recipe for disaster.
He's not wrong to be concerned. The MOU framework that's been proposed essentially attempts to formalize certain security arrangements, but the critics, and there are many, argue it creates perverse incentives. It locks in a set of expectations that don't match how either side actually behaves on the ground. When you formalize an arrangement that neither party is genuinely committed to, you don't get peace. You get a documented record of violations.
You get a grievance archive.
A grievance archive with diplomatic weight. And once things are in writing, every violation becomes a leverage point. The MOU doesn't reduce conflict, it just changes the terrain of the conflict.
We've got active strikes in the north, a ceasefire that isn't ceasing fire, diplomatic talks that are wobbling, and a formal framework that might actually make things worse. That's the backdrop Daniel is trying to stay informed about, while also packing boxes and keeping a toddler alive.
The psychological layer here matters enormously. He mentioned that everyone feels the desire to tune out. That's not weakness, that's a rational response to an information environment that is designed to overwhelm you.
Say more about that.
The news cycle in Israel during a security crisis has a specific rhythm. You get the initial alert, sirens, push notifications, whatever. Then you get the flood. Every channel, every WhatsApp group, every social media platform is saturated. Then you get the speculation phase, where retired generals and former intelligence officials are on air offering analysis that's often wrong. Then you get the government messaging, which is frequently contradicted by other government messaging within hours.
The false messages from the government that Daniel mentioned, that's not paranoia. That's a documented pattern.
During the Iranian strikes, there were multiple instances where official statements downplayed events that were later confirmed to be significant, or vice versa. The credibility gap is real. And when you can't trust the official sources, you have to triangulate. That tripling of the cognitive load is what burns people out.
Let's talk about what Daniel's actually doing right, because he's already built a system that many people don't have. He's got a go bag. He's got checklists. He's got standard operating procedures. He's got a sequence for raising situational awareness when things look like they're about to escalate. And he said those escalations often were timely.
He's essentially built an aviation-style readiness protocol for his household. And that's impressive. Most people don't get past the theoretical, we should probably have a plan stage. He's operationalized it.
The fact that he's been doing this for a year, he called it 1 year of practice, if you can call it that, means he's had enough repetitions to refine the system. The first few times you run an emergency protocol, everything is clumsy. You forget steps. You get the order wrong. By the 10th time, it's muscle memory.
That's the aviation model exactly. Pilots don't think through their emergency checklists. They've drilled them so many times that the checklist is a verification tool, not an instruction manual. What Daniel's describing is that he's reached a point where the sequence is internalized, and now the question is about the monitoring layer that sits on top of it. How do you keep it raised without it becoming exhausting? And I think there are a few principles here that actually work.
Walk me through them.
First one, decouple monitoring from consumption. These are two completely different activities that most people treat as the same thing. Consumption is reading the analysis pieces, watching the panel discussions, scrolling through the thread of hot takes. Monitoring is checking specific indicators against a threshold. You're not trying to understand the geopolitical implications of a development. You're trying to answer one question, has anything changed that requires me to act?
Monitoring is binary. Something happened or it didn't. Action required or not.
And the key is to identify what your actual indicators are ahead of time, when you're calm, not in the moment. If you wait until things are heating up to decide what you're looking for, you'll look at everything. That's how you get sucked into the scroll.
What kind of indicators are we talking about?
Concrete, observable, and ideally from primary sources. Not is the situation deteriorating. That's an interpretation, not an indicator. An indicator is, have airspace restrictions been imposed over a specific area? Has the home front command changed its alert level for a specific region? Have certain government officials or military figures gone silent or made unexpected public appearances? Have specific diplomatic channels been publicly acknowledged as suspended?
These are things you can check in 30 seconds.
If you set up your monitoring correctly, yes. And this is where the system design matters. You want a small number of high signal sources that update infrequently, not the news channels. The Homefront Command app, for instance, pushes alerts for your designated area. That's a primary source. Flight radar data is publicly available and changes in military air traffic patterns are often visible before anything is announced.
The relatives abroad texting you. Indicator, while effective, has a latency problem.
It's a lagging indicator. By the time international media is covering something and relatives are reaching out, events have already been in motion for a while. In the Iranian ballistic missile case, Daniel described, those missiles were in the air before the international coverage kicked in. The siren was the real-time indicator.
Principle 1. Separate monitoring from consumption and define your indicators in advance. What's Principle 2?
Time box the consumption. If you're going to read analysis and follow developments in depth, and there are good reasons to do that, put walls around it. Designate specific windows. 15 minutes in the morning, 15 minutes in the evening. Not whenever I have a free moment, because free moments expand to fill available anxiety.
The algorithm knows this. It will happily fill every free moment with escalating urgency.
The algorithm is not your friend here. The algorithm optimizes for engagement, and nothing engages like fear. If you open a news app without a specific time boundary, you will still be there 40 minutes later, and you will feel worse, and you will not actually be better informed. You'll just have consumed more speculation.
There's a distinction here between being informed and feeling informed. They're often inversely correlated.
That's a very good way to put it. The feeling of being informed, the sense of, I'm on top of this, is seductive, but it's mostly an illusion created by volume. Actually being informed means you know the few things that matter and you filtered out the noise. That takes less time, not more.
Monitoring is binary and fast. Consumption is time-boxed. What's the third piece?
This one's harder. You need a trusted triangulation partner. Someone outside your household who's watching the same indicators and can serve as a reality check. The reason this matters is that threat assessment in isolation tends to drift. You either become desensitized and miss things, or you become hypervigilant and see threats everywhere.
The desensitization path is what Daniel's worried about. That he'll tune out during a busy period and miss something critical.
And the hypervigilance path is the other failure mode. You start seeing patterns that aren't there, escalating your readiness based on noise. Both are errors. A triangulation partner helps correct for both.
Who's the right person for that?
Ideally, someone who shares your threat model but not your daily life. Same geographic area, same basic assessment of what the risks are, but different information diet. If you're both consuming different sources, you're more likely to catch things the other missed. And the check-in doesn't need to be elaborate. A two-line message, seeing anything I should be aware of? Nothing on my end, northern border is quiet.
The buddy system for existential dread.
It sounds flippant, but it's effective. And it addresses a specific psychological problem, which is that threat monitoring is lonely. When you're the one carrying the mental load of staying informed for your family, there's no one checking your work. You don't know if you're overreacting or underreacting.
Far we've got. Decouple monitoring from consumption, time box consumption, and find a triangulation partner.
The fourth principle is probably the most counterintuitive, schedule your tuning out. Daniel mentioned that everyone feels the desire to tune out the world right now, and the instinct is to fight that, to force yourself to stay engaged because tuning out feels irresponsible. But the cognitive science on this is pretty clear. Sustained vigilance is impossible. Your attention is a limited resource, and if you don't deliberately rest it, it will rest itself, usually at the worst possible moment.
The break he took before the Iranian missile launch.
He didn't plan to tune out at a critical moment. He tuned out because he was exhausted, and the timing happened to coincide with an escalation. If he'd scheduled his disengagement, he might have been more alert when it mattered.
The idea is to consciously decide, I'm not going to check the news between these hours. I'm going to be fully present with packing boxes, or playing with my son, or whatever it is, and I'm not going to feel guilty about it, because this is part of the system.
And the guilt piece is important. The guilt is what keeps people half engaged, scrolling while half watching their kid, reading headlines while having a conversation. You're neither present nor informed, you're just anxious in two places at once.
The worst of both worlds.
The absolute worst. Whereas, if you say, from 8 p.m. to 8 a.m., I'm offline, no news, no alerts, except the emergency push notifications, you're making a strategic decision. You're preserving your capacity to be vigilant when it counts.
Let's talk about the moving apartment dimension of this, because Daniel specifically mentioned that they're in the middle of a move, and that this is when things slip. I think that's right. When life is at maximum operational complexity, the monitoring systems are the first thing to degrade.
Because monitoring feels optional in a way that packing the kitchen doesn't. You can't not pack the kitchen, the boxes are there, the move is happening, but checking the news, that can wait. And then it waits too long.
The cognitive load of moving with a one-year-old is already immense. You're making hundreds of micro-decisions a day about where things go, what to keep, what to throw out, how to coordinate logistics. Adding threat monitoring on top of that without a system means it just won't happen consistently.
This is where automation becomes useful. If you can offload the initial filter to something that doesn't require your active attention, you've reduced the burden enormously. Set up keyword alerts for specific terms related to your threat indicators. Not Israel-Iran war, that's going to fire constantly. Specific military units, specific geographic terms, specific types of incidents.
The Homefront Command app already does geographic filtering. That's the obvious one.
Right. But that only covers official alerts. For the pre-alert phase, the period where something is developing but hasn't been officially acknowledged, you want something else. Certain Telegram channels that monitor military movements with a track record of accuracy. The key is that these are passive. You set them up once and they notify you when something crosses a threshold. You're not actively checking.
During the move, Daniel could essentially reduce his active monitoring to check the Homefront Command app once in the morning, glance at whatever automated alerts have fired, and do a 5-minute scan of the high signal sources. Everything else is passive.
That's sustainable during a high-stress period. It's not perfect, no system is. But it's far better than the alternative, which is intending to stay on top of things and then failing because you're exhausted.
There's also a physical dimension question here. They're moving to a new apartment. The go bag and the SOPs were designed for the old apartment. How do you maintain readiness during a transition when your physical environment is in flux?
The go bag is the obvious one. It needs to be accessible and its location needs to be known to both adults. During a move, the go bag should probably be one of the last things packed and one of the first things positioned in the new place. It should never be in a box.
Labeled miscellaneous and buried under the winter coats.
And the SOPs, the sequence for raising awareness, the checklist for what to do when things escalate, those need to be reviewed for the new apartment. Where's the shelter? What's the route from the bedroom, from the baby's room? Does the new building have a different access procedure?
This is the kind of thing that's easy to put off. We'll figure out the shelter situation once we're settled. But the whole point of Daniel's system is that things can escalate before you're settled.
The first week in a new place is when you're most vulnerable. You don't know the building, you don't know the neighbors, you don't have muscle memory for where things are. If something happens during that window, you're operating from a much weaker position.
The move itself becomes part of the preparedness checklist. Day 1 in the new apartment, locate the shelter, walk the route, position the go bag, verify that the Homefront Command app has the updated address.
And it might feel absurd to do that while there are still boxes everywhere, but it's exactly the right instinct.
Let's zoom out a bit. Daniel asked what a reasonable posture looks like. Not a perfect one, a reasonable one. What's your sense of where that line is?
A reasonable posture is one you can sustain indefinitely without degrading your ability to function in daily life. If your preparedness routine is making you worse at your job, worse as a parent, worse as a spouse, it's not reasonable. It's maladaptive.
The measure isn't, am I maximally informed at all times? It's, am I informed enough to act in time? And can I keep this up for months or years?
And that second part, the sustainability, is what most preparedness advice misses. People design systems for a crisis that lasts 3 days. Daniel's been living in a rolling crisis for over a year. The system has to account for human fatigue.
The other thing about reasonable posture, it has to tolerate imperfection. You're going to miss things. You're going to have days where you don't check the news at all. The system needs to be resilient to that.
That's where the triangulation partner helps. If you miss a day, your partner might not have. If both of you miss it, it probably wasn't that significant. The redundancy creates slack.
There's something else in Daniel's prompt that I want to pull on. He said there's absolutely nothing to instill confidence. The government's messaging isn't trustworthy. The ceasefires don't hold. The diplomatic framework seemed counterproductive. And I think part of what makes the vigilance exhausting is that it's happening in an environment of deep institutional mistrust.
That's a really important point. When you trust the institutions, you could delegate some of your vigilance to them. You assume that if something major is happening, the authorities will sound the alarm. When you don't trust them, you have to do all the detection yourself.
That's a much heavier lift.
It's the difference between having a smoke detector and having to sniff the air constantly. The smoke detector does the monitoring for you. If you don't trust the smoke detector, you never sleep well.
Part of the challenge is that Daniel is operating in an environment where the official smoke detectors have a history of false negatives and false positives. They've cried wolf, and they've also stayed silent when there was a wolf.
The rational response to an unreliable alarm system is to build your own. That's what he's done with the go bag and the SOPs and the monitoring sequence. But building your own alarm system is exhausting because you're doing the work that institutions are supposed to do.
Which circles back to sustainability. You can't be your own home front command indefinitely.
You can't. And I think the honest answer, and this is where it gets uncomfortable, is that a reasonable posture in this environment involves accepting a certain level of irreducible risk. You cannot eliminate the possibility of being surprised. You can reduce it, but you can't eliminate it. And making peace with that is part of what allows you to function.
That's a hard thing to say to someone with a 1-year-old.
And I don't say it lightly. But the alternative, trying to achieve perfect vigilance, doesn't actually deliver perfect safety. It delivers burnout, which makes you less safe. There's a point where additional vigilance has negative returns.
The preparedness paradox.
The more you prepare, the safer you feel. But beyond a certain threshold, the preparation itself starts degrading your quality of life and your cognitive capacity. And that makes you less safe, not more.
Let's get concrete. If Daniel were sitting here and asking for a specific actionable framework, what would you give him?
I'd give him 4 layers. Layer 1, passive monitoring. The Homefront Command app, automated keyword alerts, flight tracking if relevant. These run in the background. He doesn't think about them unless they fire. Layer 2, active check-ins. Twice a day, 5 minutes each, scanning the high signal sources against his predefined indicators. Morning and evening, same time every day, no exceptions and no extensions. Layer 3, the triangulation partner. A 30-second check-in once a day with someone who shares his threat model. Layer 4, scheduled disengagement. Designated hours where he is offline from news entirely, no guilt, no exceptions.
The go bag and SOPs are the action layer that sits underneath all of that. When the monitoring layers fire, the action layer activates.
And the action layer needs to be maintained separately from the monitoring. The go bag gets refreshed periodically regardless of the threat level. The SOPs get reviewed and updated when circumstances change, like moving apartments.
I think there's also a meta layer here that's worth naming. Daniel mentioned that he and his wife are doing this together. They're both responsible for their son's safety. And I wonder how much of the cognitive load is falling on him versus being distributed.
That's a really important question, and it's one that couples often don't discuss explicitly. Who's carrying the mental load of threat monitoring? Is it shared? Is there a primary and a backup? What happens if the primary is sick or exhausted or just needs a break?
Because if the system depends on one person being vigilant, it's not a system. It's a single point of failure.
And in a household with a 1-year-old, both parents are already operating at reduced capacity. Sleep deprivation alone impairs judgment. Adding solo threat monitoring on top of that is a lot to ask of anyone.
Part of the framework should be explicit about roles. I'm primary this week, your backup. Or, I handle the morning check-in, you handle the evening. Something that makes the distribution of labor visible.
That also creates accountability in a healthy way. If you know your partner is counting on you to do the evening scan, you're more likely to actually do it. Not out of fear, but out of commitment to the shared system.
We've talked a lot about the mechanics. Let's talk about the emotional layer for a minute. Daniel mentioned that everyone feels the desire to tune out the world. And I think there's something specific about the Israeli experience here that's worth naming. There's a particular kind of exhaustion that comes from living in a conflict that the rest of the world treats as a spectacle. You're not just dealing with the threat. You're dealing with the knowledge that your life is being discussed on panels in Washington and London and wherever else, usually by people who have never been here and don't understand the first thing about it.
That creates a weird kind of doubling. You're living your life and also watching yourself be narrated. The relatives texting from abroad are part of that. They're watching the narration and checking it against your reality.
Is it as bad as it looks on television? Is a question that contains multitudes.
It really does. Because the answer is almost always, it's more complicated than that. But you don't have the energy to explain the complexity to someone whose primary reference point is a Chiron.
I think that's part of why tuning out feels so appealing. It's not just tuning out the threat. It's tuning out the narration of the threat. The bad analysis. The relatives who mean well but add to the cognitive load.
The well-meaning relative is an underappreciated source of burnout. Every stay safe message is a small reminder that you're in danger, and you have to process that emotionally while also responding politely.
There's a social dimension to managing the antenna. Part of the system might need to include boundaries around how much external concern you're willing to absorb.
That's uncomfortable to say out loud. These are people who care about you. But caring doesn't automatically make the interaction helpful. Sometimes it just adds weight.
All right, let's step back and look at the big picture. Daniel's been doing this for a year. He's built a system that works well enough that he can identify its weak points. He's asking how to make it sustainable during periods of high life stress. What's the one thing you'd want him to take away from this conversation?
I think the core insight is that vigilance is a resource, not a virtue. You don't get points for being maximally vigilant at all times. You get points for being vigilant enough to act when action is needed, while preserving your capacity to be a functional human being the rest of the time. Treat your attention like a budget, not like a moral obligation.
The corollary, systems beat willpower. The reason his SOPs and checklists work is that they don't depend on him being at his best. They work when he's tired, distracted, and overwhelmed. The monitoring layer needs the same treatment. Don't try to be disciplined. Build a system that doesn't require discipline.
Willpower is what fails when you're exhausted. A A well-designed system is what catches you when willpower gives out.
I think there's one more thing worth saying. Daniel mentioned that he's still not sure what a reasonable posture or a good answer to this challenge is. And I think the fact that he's asking the question, after a year of living this, after building the systems, after going through multiple escalations, is itself the answer. The reasonable posture is the one that keeps asking the question.
Say more about that.
The people who burn out are the ones who think they've figured it out. They stop adjusting. They stop questioning whether their system is still appropriate. Daniel's uncertainty isn't a weakness. It's the thing that keeps his system alive and evolving. He's calibrating.
Complacency is the real enemy, not imperfect vigilance. The person who thinks they've got it handled is the one who gets surprised. The person who's constantly asking, "Is this still working?" is the one who catches things.
The answer is, keep doing what you're doing, but give yourself permission to do less of it. Build the passive layers. Time box the active ones. Find a partner. Schedule the disengagement. And accept that the system will never be perfect, because the environment won't let it be.
Move the go bag first.
Move the go bag first.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
The term seamount entered English in the 1810s through the journals of British naval surveyors charting the Gilbert Islands, now part of Kiribati. What makes this etymologically interesting is that the local Gilbertese already had distinct names for submerged peaks versus emergent atolls, a taxonomic precision that English collapsed into a single word, losing the distinction between seamounts that posed navigation hazards and those that didn't.
Right. This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop. You can find us at myweirdprompts.com or wherever you get your podcasts. If you've got a question you want us to dig into, send it our way.
Until next time.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.